On this episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, we are still waiting for the CMS 2020 proposed rate and regulatory update. We will discuss some activities in some different states that affect the ASCs and discuss the latest news and talk about sharp safety.
Welcome to the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, a podcast for anyone interested in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry. This episode is sponsored by Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. The ASC regulatory environment is increasingly challenging, but organizations that outsource their regulatory oversight to Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies have an edge. AHS works with ASCs to oversee their quality improvement, risk management, emergency and infection control programs, run their meetings, develop education programs, and always be prepared for surveys.
Welcome to episode 61 of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey for July 28th, 2019. We're recording from our studio in Rochester, New York. This is Sue Cronkite, Senior Nurse Consultant with AHS, and I'm here with John Gailey, the owner of Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies and one of the leading experts in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry, and the author and co-author of over 10 books about the ASC industry, including the Survey Guide for ASCs. John speaks frequently at both national and state ASC meetings on a wide variety of topics. So we're going into, well, you're going into a crazy week. I'm home. I'll be working, but I'm not running all over the place.
I've got, I actually leave in about 3 hours, I think, for a whirlwind trip across the, well, at least the East Coast here. So I head to New York City, take care of a couple clients down there, down to Venice, Florida for one of my favorite clients, though not so much at this time of year. It's a little hot down there.
Yes.
I mean, the client I'm very happy with.
Yeah, still like them, but
not so much the weather.
The locale.
And then on to Alexandria, Virginia, in the ASC Association headquarters for a meeting of the Board of Ambulatory Surgery Certification. And then back to New York, and then back home. So.
And then Aruba. The best part.
On to Aruba.
Yep. Heading there next weekend.
Right. Well-deserved vacation, though. Yeah. And when you own your own business, it's not always a vacation, so.
Yeah, but if we're going to be working, let's work from Aruba.
That's right. So, I mean, people don't seem to be feeling bad for us when we're working on our computer at the beach with our...
I'll be floating through the lazy river with my computer propped on my...
That's right. I did want to kind of be a Debbie Downer for a second. I do want to say that this was a rough week, especially for Sue. We lost one of our doggies this week. Yeah. So she was a fixture in our podcast because she was always walking around. So unfortunately, she passed away on Monday. And so I'd like to dedicate today's episode to that, to her. How's that? And we certainly miss you, Haley.
Yes.
So let's talk about some of the news in the industry.
Okay, so as I mentioned at the beginning, we just wanted to mention some changes that are happening around the whole U.S., different states, and I know even if you're not in a particular state, may not affect you, but I think it kind of shows the trends that could be happening.
Right. We're going to try to do this a little more frequently, too, because I think we've always tried to avoid talking too much about individual states, but it's good for the people that, of course, listen from those states as well as kind of watching the trends going on.
Yeah, just to see what's happening.
Yeah, to that end, you know, New York State, where we live and many of our clients exist, has implemented some stricter CONs. So that's a certificate of need application. So in New York, in order to operate an ambulatory surgery center, you do have to have a certificate of need. And we've gone through a period of relatively, I don't know if I want to call it loose, but loosened regulations with regard to certificate of need applications. And there were some changes recently that are going to help. The goal is to try to protect some of the smaller hospitals in small towns throughout New York. Believe it or not, the entire state is not the city of New York, as as we all know, living, I'm looking out at
upstate,
beautiful forest that we live in here in upstate New York, certainly not at all like our clients in New York City. But up in the northern part of the state, there are a lot of towns and villages that have small town hospitals, and the state is trying to find a way to protect them. And fortunately, one of the ways they hope to do that is by making it more difficult for surgery centers to build in areas that are ruled by a single hospital. Mm-hmm.
So they feel it might be affected.
Right. So that's going to make things a little bit more difficult for those areas, and we'll have to keep a close eye on that.
Kind of the opposite of that, North Carolina is considering legislation that would allow single specialty ASCs to become multi-specialty centers without a certificate of need review. They could just move right into that.
So. Right, right. That's definitely a move in my view, the right direction. I think competition is very healthy, personally. You know, that's why I've always been happy with what happened in New York and kind of sad that we're moving in the direction. So,
And Florida law was passed permitting ASCs to keep patients for up to 24 hours. That's been following many years of debate. And by the way, all this information I got out of Becker's, they always have a lot of news from the industry and keeping us all up to date. So I did want to credit them for all of this.
And that, of course, is at beckersasc.com. Mm-hmm. Getting back to Florida quickly. So the Florida law is kind of following a trend in the U.S. where, you know, we know that Medicare does allow you to keep a patient up to 24 hours, but not all states have allowed that. So I think that's a trend that might be continuing throughout the country. We'll have to keep a close eye on that one.
And I wanted to mention some other news medication related. If your diabetic patients are taking a class of medications called gliflozin. It's recommended that you test for the acid load in their blood before surgery because these medications can mask the symptoms of ketoacidosis. So simply testing their blood sugar may not be sufficient. And, you know, after surgery complications can be hard to recognize as being part of ketoacidosis if you don't know going into it. So it's just something to keep in mind.
So I think what that means is if during the pre-op phone call, you find out that they're on gliflozin, ask them to get that test because that's not a waiver test at this point, the acid load, right?
Okay. So it's just something, you know, so it's not all diabetic patients, but that one particular medication to be aware of. And I saw on ASCA, they have a printable info sheet about what is an ASC that you can print out, give to your patients. They also have one that's more directed at your government officials that you can send to them. But it's colorful, touting the benefits of the ASC for patients and for the economy and all that. So it's right on there.
Yeah, and August is ASC is the month where ASC Associations sponsors a lot of events publicizing the advantages of using ambulatory surgery centers. So it's a good month to start using something like that. So definitely, you know, anything we can do to help our patients know a little bit more about us and to be understanding of our industry and hopefully supportive of it. So let's take a break and we'll come back and we'll talk about Sharp Safety.
So when we were trying to decide what to talk about this week,
given that the CMS regulations did not come out,
and we're still waiting.
that was what the podcast was supposed to be about. Yep. So.
But you know, we thought one of the really important things that we haven't talked a whole lot about is Sharp Safety. That's something that is always an ongoing issue, not just compliance wise, but you know, safety wise for your your employees. So.
Yeah, it does seem like a number of the incidents that pop up during the quarter in our various centers revolve around different types of sharp safety issues. Yeah. You know, fortunately, none of them are ever very serious, but nonetheless, they could be much more serious. And I think that's why we have to take them serious.
So, they cause a lot of stress and a lot of concern, and you just don't want to take those risks.
Right. So let's just start with the HHHC standards, talk a little bit about that, mainly because HHHC probably has the most specific standards when I was looking at all the accreditation organizations and CMS. So in HHHC standards, Chapter 7, you're required to have a written Sharps Injury Prevention Program, and that program has to include documentation of employee orientation, annual staff education, and annual education as needed. And what they're more specific even there. It says evidence of education at Sharps Injury Prevention is provided within 30 days of employment and annually thereafter and when there is an identified need. And I want to point out something here is that it's important to realize, and we've talked about this before, that we have our annual education, we have our orientation, but our in-services are an opportunity to kind of, based upon identified areas to...
Specifically.
Right.
Yeah.
And this is one of those areas that we find, you know, we've had to create a number of programs for our clients just to kind of enhance what happens during the orientation and the annual mandatory when we run into problems. And it does not, it depends upon the employee. Some people just don't, you know, have a lot of education. And quite frankly, sometimes it's the doctors. Actually, some of the statistics out there show that the largest number of injuries are on physicians in sharp injury. So these ongoing educational programs and different programs should be part of your retinue of things that you do on a regular basis in your organization. Mm-hmm. The standards chapter 7 goes on to talk about the disposal of intact needles and syringes into appropriate puncture-resistant sharps containers in accordance with federal and state regulations. Placement of those sharps containers in appropriate care areas secured from tampering. So you shouldn't be able to get in and out.
No, but they should be close so you can reach them and not have to have someplace you're leaving the needles in the interim if at all possible.
Right. And Sue, you keep running into problems with one client of ours that doesn't like to put the closures on the top of those, those containers.
Which is just concern, especially if it's in an area where other people can reach it.
Right.
Or lower to the ground. As a pediatric nurse, I see those things, and I just can picture a child walking by it. So you've just got to be, you know, be aware of that stuff.
So what we're talking about is making sure that there's a one-way entrance into the sharps container there.
Exactly.
Replacement of sharps containers when they reach the fill line, which is kind of another thing. The other day I was in a place and a needle was actually kind of sticking out.
Yeah.
Of the sharps container, which is about as dangerous as it can get. And, you know, I'm looking at it and I realize the reason it was sticking out is because it had already reached the fill line. So you have to be very careful.
Or they can, if it's attached still to an IV line, this has happened someplace else and, you know, just kind of got caught up as it was being put in and it wasn't all the way in there and somebody actually did accidentally get poked with that.
Well, there's almost no way to protect yourself against that too. So very important. Handling, storage, and disposal of filled sharps containers are done in accordance with the applicable regulations. So that's all Chapter 7. Chapter 10, which is the surgical chapter, talks about having a written process that identifies the type of procedures requiring counts of sponges, sharps, and instruments. Have a count before you start the procedure and before skin closure and reporting at the start and at the end to the surgeon. And then documentation of those counts in the patient's record. Very, very important area.
And, of course, OSHA has something to say about this.
As I do with everything.
Yes. Well, it's good. They're protecting us.
Yes.
That we must have engineering controls, meaning sharps disposal containers, self-sheathing needles, medical devices such as sharps with engineered injury protections and needleless systems that isolate or remove the bloodborne pathogen hazard from the workplace. And the way I always think about it, you're taking out the human factor because people will make mistakes. So let's have as many safeguards in place as you can.
And we should point out here that OSHA does require you to have an annual evaluation of various safety needles and sharps. And that should be documented and that should actually go even to the governing body as part of a report there as to what decision have been made. It's all right for you to make the decision not to use these, but you need to give the employees the opportunity to review these things. And that's an important thing is that this isn't an evaluation by management. This is an evaluation by the people that use it.
People would be much more willing to use something if they have chosen it themselves. It's a great idea, but only if it's only if you have that buy-in.
And it's going to be harder for you to not use those things if you start to have injury in sharps injuries in your organization.
Yeah.
So I would say after you've had you know, one or two injuries in a year, if you've never had them before, that's the time to start evaluating again or doing a second evaluation. Just because you did it once in a year doesn't mean that you shouldn't consider doing it a second time. Joint Commission and QuadASF, they pretty much follow the CMS requirements, which we're going to talk about in a second. Unlike HHHC, they're not terribly specific, but they do have very general standards that talk about the importance of developing a program that protects you from sharps, et cetera. QuadASF does have their 200.08 medical hazardous waste, though, that does say that used disposable sharp items are placed in a secure puncture-resistant containers, which are located as close to the use areas as practical. It doesn't really say anything specifically about those the programs themselves, but let's get into CMS now.
The section 416.51A standard, sanitary environment. The ASC must provide a functional and sanitary environment for the provision of surgical services by adhering to professionally acceptable standards of practice.
So this is the overall standard that really would be most likely quoted when it comes to a sharp injury. Okay. And the interpretive guidelines for this area state quite a bit. I'll just quote part of it, and that says, the ASC must provide and maintain a functional and sanitary environment for surgical services to avoid sources and transmissions of infections and communicable diseases. All areas of the ASC must be clean and sanitary. The ASC must appropriately monitor, you know, various things such as housekeeping, maintenance, and other activities, which is where we're getting right now, to ensure the functional and sanitary environment. So policies and procedures for sanitary and functional environment should address various issues. And one of those issues, there's multiple ones, talks about the techniques for the disposal of regulated and non-regulated wastes. And then it goes on to be even more specific. Again, these are in the interpretive guidelines for 41651A. These activities must be conducted in accordance with professionally recognized standards of infection control practice. And examples of the organizations that would promulgate those would be the CDC, APIC, SHEA, which is the Society for Healthcare Epidemiology in America, and AORN, of course, the Association of Perioperative Registered Nurses. So this is the area that you're going to be cited if they identify ongoing issues with regard to sharp safety. So 41651B, the standard also in infection prevention, talks about, basically states that the ASC must maintain an ongoing program designed to prevent, control, and investigate infections and communicable diseases. And in addition, the Infection Control and Prevention Program must include documentation that the ASC has considered, selected, and implemented nationally recognized infection control guidelines. So it's important that we're constantly monitoring those guidelines out there, that we're adapting to changes in those guidelines and standards in the community and, of course, nationally. And specifically in the interpretive guidelines, it does say that you must have measures specific to safe practices for injecting medications and saline or other infusates.
And for sharp safety surveillance, this is something that should be done every month to survey the organization for sharp safety issues performed by the infection control preventionist.
No, it could be delegated to other people, but usually it has to kind of rise to the level, to such a high level that the infection control preventionist has to do it. So here's just a couple examples of things that we should look at, and let's just alternate this.
Okay. So we'd look at single-dose, single-use medication vials that they're being used for only one patient.
Which seems kind of obvious, but yes, not always.
But
multi-dose medication vials used for more than one patient are stored appropriately and do not enter the immediate patient care area, such as the operating room or anesthesia carts. That's a big one right there.
Yeah,
it can be hard. Yeah, a lot of times. I just saw it this week in a place, I mean, that's not a client of ours, but it was just right on top of an anesthesia cart, a multi-dose vial. Mm-hmm.
And if multi-dose vials enter the immediate care area, they are dedicated for that single patient use and they're discarded immediately after use. So basically used as a single-use vial.
Right. Medications that are pre-drawn are labeled with the date and time of draw, initials of the person drawing, medication name, strength, and the beyond use date and time. And again, another area that especially our dear anesthesiologists are not always complying with.
Mm-hmm. Bags of IV solutions are used for only one patient. And I mean, it gives me chills. You really, and not as a source of flush solution for multiple patients, please.
Right. Medication administration tubing and connectors are used for only one patient. I know all this is obvious, but I guess we should state it.
New syringes, needles, or cannulas are used each time an IV line or bag is accessed.
Sterile single-use syringes are always used for any type of injection or infusion.
Needles, cannulas, and syringes are always used as single-use items and are never reused on other patients or to access medications or solutions more than once. And I think this, I mean, although I really don't think anybody is going to use a needle or a syringe on multiple patients, it's using and multiple vials for that one patient is sometimes where people get tripped up. They think, well, it's just going from one vial to another, but that you can't do that.
Right. Medications are never administered from the same syringe or needle to more than one patient.
Used needles are discarded immediately after use, and they're not recapped, bent, cut, removed from the syringe, or otherwise manipulated. So having the sharps container nearby is very helpful.
And this is actually an area where people do tend to get a little sloppy. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they want to recap them, or so we have to be careful here. The safety devices are activated immediately after each use.
Medications are prepared and drawn in clean areas that do not have other biological materials, used equipment, or food present.
So what we're talking about here is just making sure that there's a safe area away from the patients, obviously, and away from any dangerous products and dedicated for its use, as you said.
Hand hygiene should always be performed at appropriate times during the medication preparation and administration.
Disposable gloves are worn according to the facility's policy and usually based upon standards promulgated by one of the major organizations.
The rubber septum on medication, whether it is unopened or previously accessed, the vial should be disinfected with alcohol prior to piercing.
And again, that's one of those things that people do tend to forget, especially upon that first time
new using opening. It. Yeah. And really, you know, scrub it.
Right. Exactly. Skin at the injection insertion site is prepared with an appropriate antiseptic, which is allowed to dry for the recommended period of time. Mm-hmm. That second part about drying is extremely important too, because only then are we guaranteed that it's worked.
When I worked in the hospital, it seemed, and this isn't really just sharps related, but anytime you're wiping down cots or doing anything, a lot of times people just forget that drying time because it's not just the cleaning, it's letting things, you know, it's killing the things as it dries.
Right. And of course, we understand because you're in a hurry to get things done. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you don't have a watch with the second hand on it.
Yeah, or things could be different, but you have to follow the instructions for the product you're using.
Right.
The injection or insertion site is not touched after skin antisepsis occurs.
IV ports are disinfected before each entry. Again, one of those things we do tend to forget about a little bit. And just a reminder.
All sharps are disposed of in a puncture-resistant sharps container.
Sharps containers are replaced when the fill line is reached, please.
Hand hygiene is performed before and after performing a finger stick procedure to obtain a sample of blood and using the point of care testing device.
Gloves are worn by healthcare personnel when performing a finger stick procedure to obtain a sample of blood and are removed after the procedure, followed, of course, by hand hygiene.
Yes. A new single-use auto-disabling lancing device should be used for each patient.
And if used for more than one patient, the point-of-care testing device, such as a blood glucose meter or an INR meter, is cleaned and disinfected after every use, according to the manufacturer's instructions. And please, that's another thing. Sometimes when you replace devices or you have a new device, they forget to get that manufacturer's instructions and keep it close to the device.
Yeah, it may not be the same as your last one.
Right. And just because you know how to use it doesn't mean that somebody else walking in is going to know how to use it. Yep. So you need to keep that very close.
Keep it all handy.
So all those items that we just went through, those are things that probably should be on a monthly checklist that you use, the infection preventionist or other designated individual will observe procedures surreptitiously or openly. Yeah. I think so. People ask me, how frequently should we do this type of surveillance? So we're required to do the surveillance as part of any of our accreditation standards and as well as the CMS standard. Mm-hmm. So the question is always, how frequently should we do it? I used to say quarterly, but I'll tell you, with the number of issues that we've had recently, I think monthly really is much more appropriate. And, you know, if you've had a couple injuries within a period of time, we had one center that had two injuries in one day, I would say at this point that they probably should be doing the sharp safety surveillance on a daily basis.
Yeah, and you are. I mean, you're there, you're around what's happening. So it's just a matter of documenting it.
Right.
And, you know, that can help you to focus your education, your in-services.
Right. In management school and in my MBA programs, we talk about management by walking around. And that's what really this is, you know, as a professional, as the manager of the infection prevention program, you should be walking around and observing these things, not just when you have a checklist in front of you, but all the time.
So people aren't looking at you with your clipboard and instantly snapping to shake. Right. You know? So you just, as you're going around and in a kind way, letting people know when they're not doing something they should be doing. And so we talked about all the things that you have to keep track of, and sometimes, though, just trying to pull it all together. So if you go to AORN, if you're a member, go to AORN.
If you're not a member, you should become a member of AORN.
Yes, absolutely.
Somebody in your organization should be a member.
Yeah, in most places, I think. They have a great toolkit that you can find posters that you can put up, you know, changing the posters out into different things sometimes just to kind of make people pay attention a little bit more. Educational materials, checklists. They have even a letter to surgeons there that, you know, if you're having somebody that it's really hard to get through to them, you can send them this letter and it kind of explains to them, hey, look at how your life might change if something, if you either were injured or you injured somebody else, you know, that all these things that you value, you know, it just to kind of make it real to them if you sort of need to shake them up.
And I did see a statistics and I wish I could remember where it was from, but I think 30% of the injuries that occur in a surgery center are for physicians. So that's an important statistic. So
I think coming from the physicians too, we've definitely, it tends to be where a lot of the issues come about. And it's not you know, this is not to blame anybody, but I think just, you know, people are focused on doing what they can for the patient and they forget that handoff is so important.
Right.
And the CDC also has a lot of resources, workbooks, posters, checklists that, you know, you can go in there and just search, you know, for sharp safety education and things. So there's a lot of stuff you can, you know, that you can access to keep the education new and keep people interested.
Change out those posters. You know, I mean, how long have we seen time? Some of them are yellowed on the walls. Mm-hmm. I know you had been talking people a little bit about, you know, then. Like laminating a whole bunch of them. And every time we went to see our clients, kind of alternating those posters there and keeping bright and, you know, colorful and whatever you need to do in order to kind of get across. Because things that are different on the wall tend to attract your attention as you walk in a daily basis.
Yeah, and you may find that some of the areas that aren't being addressed, they're, you know, they're just a little bit different, whether it's during the handoff, whether it's... One thing we had been talking to one of our clients about is having that neutral zone, the no-touch handoff. And, you know, you can make that part of your timeout if you find it's been an issue, just to identify that spot, make everybody aware, okay, remember, you're putting the sharps down there. You're not handing it off.
Right.
You can do kind of a modified handoff if your doctors are doing a procedure where they can't take their eyes off the field, where the doctor can drop it into the basin or onto the magnetic pad, but when they're being handed the sharps, that the tech can, you know, hand it to the doctor.
Right.
But so at least then they're not handing it back. Yeah, it's like a half. You're using it for half the time. You know, there's just sometimes you have to be creative with your techniques, but you just want to do what you can to stop any kind of issues.
So make this as a priority. I mean, definitely sharp injuries can have a significant impact on the staff that are affected by it. And, you know, take this serious. So hopefully this episode and our discussion will help you be better prepared. Let's take a break and we'll come back and talk about various events in the ASC industry. So let's talk about some of the upcoming events in the ASC industry.
Every episode, we will inform you of upcoming events. If you would like your event to be included in the podcast, please send the event information to info@ascpodcast.com.
And we'd also like to remind you that the ASC Podcast with John Gailey is available to go on the road to support your state association or any other organization within the ASC industry. I'm available to speak, and the podcast can record a podcast from your meeting. And I think I noted last time that two of the most successful podcasts that we have, the largest number of downloads are for the New York Association and the New Jersey Association meetings. And I know the California Association is coming up soon, so I'm sure that'll become a very popular episode also.
The next ASC Association webinar, Taking the Infection Preventionist Seriously, part of ASCA's 2019 webinar series, is August 6, 2019 at 1 o'clock.
The Georgia State ASC Association and the South Carolina State Association joint semiannual meeting is August 15th through the 16th, 2019 at the DeSoto in Savannah, Georgia.
The California Ambulatory Surgery Association is September 4th through 6th in Monterey Bay, California.
And we will be there at the association. I'm going to be moderating one of the sessions, and we'll record an episode from there. The Tennessee ASC Association Fall Conference and Trade Show is September 26th through the 27th at the Hilton Memphis in Memphis, Tennessee.
The South Carolina ASC Association's Infection Control Seminar is in Columbia, South Carolina, October 5th.
And also, the South Carolina ASC Association fourth quarter membership meeting is 3 days later in Columbia, South Carolina, October 8th, 2019.
The Indiana Federation of ASC's Fall Conference and Trade Show is October 18th, 2019 at 502 East Event Center in Carmel, Indiana.
The New York Metro ASC and Healthcare Management Symposium is November 1st, 2019 at the Marriott Marquis.
The New York State Association of ASC's Fall Conference in Tarrytown, New York is on November 6th and 7th, 2019.
And the Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies team will be there in mass on for that conference, and we're working on the schedule right now.
The Washington ASC Association's 2019 Annual Education Conference and Trade Show is November 14th and 15th. At the Tulalip Resort and Spa in Tulalip, Washington.
And lastly, we would want to remind you to very quickly sign up for the CASC registration for the September 1st through the 30th exam period. So you have until July 31st to sign up for the CASC exam, and that's at aboutcasc.org.
Well, that's it for this episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey. Join us again next time and spread the word about our podcast with your friends and colleagues, and do us the honor of hitting the subscribe button.
This podcast is an educational and operational tool and is not intended to be a comprehensive resource for all the rules, regulations, and standards that an ambulatory surgery center must meet. The advice provided should not be considered as, nor does it constitute legal advice or opinion. When reviewing specific situations involving legal and regulatory issues, attorneys and other professionals should be consulted. This has been a production of Eden Group Development, all rights reserved. We would like to thank this week's sponsors. First, Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, one of the nation's leading regulatory compliance and financial oversight firms. For a free consultation, contact John Gailey today at 585-594-1167 or through email at info@ah-strategies.com. And Eden Group Development, which publishes ASC Regulatory Compliance Series, the ASC industry's leading books, including the Survey Guide for ASCs, a guide to the CMS conditions for coverage and interpretive guidelines for ambulatory surgery centers, and Ambulatory Surgery Center Governance, a guide for ambulatory surgery center owners and governing body members. These must-have books are available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble or directly from the publisher at reg-books.com. That's reg-books.com. If you're interested in advertising or sponsoring the ASC podcast with John Gailey, please email us at info@ascpodcast.com. We would love to hear your questions and comments. Please email us at comments@ascpodcast.com.